Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is our paranormal afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. You can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 100 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. This week, I'm talking to Maxime Thurick about his book, The Schmerl Haunting, When Ed and Lorraine Came to Town. Maxime has been featured on countless American, Canadian, and European podcasts. He is a contributor to Fate magazine, Paranormal Underground, and Strange Knocks, and a frequent guest speaker at paranormal conferences. Hi, Maxime. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you, Simon. This is great. I mean, I enjoyed the conversation we had the last time. And, I'm really excited about telling your listeners about my latest book, The Schmerl Haunting, When Ed and Lorraine Came to Town. So this is just a very opportune moment for me.
My first question is, for those listeners that don't know, who are Ed and Lorraine?
Okay, Ed and Lorraine Warren were infamous demonologists. They were Roman Catholic demonologists. They were from Monroe, Connecticut. And they were sort of like ambassadors of demonology. I mean, they educated the world as to the realm of demonology and what it, allegedly represented, as far as the progression of temptation, infestation, and possession, means that a person could become possessed, all of that. So they sort of gave us the framework. And I think that Ed and Lorraine Warren were to demonology as, say, Sybil Leek was to witchcraft. You know, both of them, with Sybil Leek in the UK, after they repealed the Witch Act, I think that people could be put to death for practicing witchcraft. But after that was repealed, Sybil Leek wrote a book, and she opened up the doors, letting people know that it was okay to practice paganism or witchcraft or the Wicca craft. So both Ed and Lorraine Warren and Sybil Leek were ambassadors to their various genres. But Ed and Lorraine Warren were the first. They were probably, they were without a doubt, the most successful, commercially successful. They charged $5,000 per lecture. They did over close to 1,000 lectures at campuses and universities across the United States. So they were well known, and they were involved in all of the notorious haunted houses, the episodes of alleged demonic infestation and possession. So they were front and center. They did their homework. They were in the trenches, and they deserve all the accolades that they can get.
And how much contact did you have with them? Because you weren't just a researcher who read about them, were you? You knew them.
Well, I did. And here's the thing, Simon. I was West Pittston, Pennsylvania, where the Schmerl haunting took place. That was right up the road for me. That is maybe like a 35-minute drive for me. And I went up there numerous times during the 1980s to check out this frenzy, these stories about paranormal infestation, this horrible stuff happening there right up the road for me. But in 1988, I found out that Ed and Lorraine were going to be in Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania. And that is a very scenic, bucolic, touristy town in the mountains of Pennsylvania. And I got permission to interview them. And I hung out with Ed and Lorraine on the sidewalks of Jim Thorpe. And we talked about demonology and all this stuff. And I took pictures. And some of my exclusive photographs of Ed and Lorraine are in the book, The Schmerl Haunting, which I'm really proud of. And then I maintained the relationship with Ed and Lorraine over the years before they died. And I would call them up and I would specifically ask questions of Ed, how he did battle with demonic forces. And Lorraine, who was a lover of animals, she would have chickens in her, or a rooster in her living room. And you can hear the rooster in the background and all that. But Ed was very, he was a bit of a mentor. He explained this to me. I think he maybe appreciated or, you know, liked my curiosity and my energy. But I would ask him questions and he would say this. He said that he would do battle with demonic forces by invoking the spirit of Jesus Christ, of Padre Pio, and of Saint Michael the Archangel. So this is how Ed Warren would go and do battle. Of course, using the crucifix and using the holy water. So it's as basic and elemental as that. It's almost like Bram Stoker's, in a sense, Dracula, where it was the garlic and it was the crucifix. And it was the prayer that, you know, that would, you know, protect you from the vampire. So, but Ed and Lorraine Warren were just, you know, wonderful people. And I considered them friends and they certainly were mentors. I can't say enough about them.
Did he ever describe the actual event while he was doing things? Because in the movies, they make it like it's a real battle and the demon shows up. And but when he was doing it, did he ever have like attacks on him or just something happen?
Yes, absolutely. And here's the thing. The age-old question remains, does evil exist and does the devil exist? And there's a lot of people that say, no, it's just a wives' tale. It's stories meant to scare us. Like, for example, if you don't say your prayers, the devil's going to get you. Or if you do this or that, you know, you're going to go to hell. So we were all raised with that fear, that religious fear, from the church, from our parents, from the society, whatever. I mean, you know, we all can relate to that. But you could either believe that there's a world of demonic energies or not. But I believe that evil does exist, that the devil does exist. And I think the devil is a deceiver, does not want us to believe that he or she exists. And if you believe in this, if you believe that there's a realm of demonology, well, then what Ed Warren connected with in all of these places, including Amityville and the Hinsdale House and the Wells House and the Schmerl Haunting, all of these places, I mean, they all had, it, when you compare and contrast, and that's pretty much what I did in the Schmerl Haunting when Ed and Lorraine came to town. I took a look at the Schmerl Haunting and compared it with other haunted houses, other places of demonic infestation. And I will say this, that the Schmerl Haunting is unique in its own right. It really is set apart from these other episodes of Conjuring.
I wanted to talk to you about that haunting. I wanted to know if Ed had real powerful experiences with this supernatural stuff.
Yeah, they did. But the thing that makes the Schmerl Haunting stand out from all the other ones is the level of intensity, the level of physical intensity that happened there. Jack Schmerl claimed that he was raped by a female demon, a succubus. And his wife, Janet, claimed that she was sexually molested by a demon. This typically doesn't happen in other haunted houses, you know, including Amityville and Hinsdale and the Wells House. But it happened at the Schmerl Haunting. The Schmerl Haunting had a higher level of violence and intensity than any of the other ones. There may be reasons for this, but Ed talked about that. He said he was, and you could see the YouTube videos, they're all over the place, but Ed said that he did a press conference off on the porch of the Schmerl Haunting, the Schmerl House, and he said that there's something here, call it a ghost or a demon or a spirit, but there's something here that's malevolent. And that's what Ed Warren told the people. The Warrens paid a visit to the Schmerl House. They spent, I believe it was 4 nights that they spent, you know, staying there in the house. They came with a nurse who was also a psychic. and they came with a photographer. So they were certainly big on the investigations as well as the publicity. They did it well. You know, they are criticized by some for being commercially successful, but you know, that's just jealousy that, on the part of others. You know, that's just they're taking a cheap shot at the Warrens for that. But they were, the Ed and Lorraine Warren were very much involved in the Schmerl haunting.
Talking of Ed and Lorraine again, but they were quite a controversial couple, weren't they? Were there a lot of people accusing them of being fakes?
Yeah, absolutely. When you look at the, it's, you know, I mean, I'm a defender. I mean, I like Ed and Lorraine because they were friends of mine, but I've heard all of the, you know, the naysayers, the critics. I mean, they are castigated by many, many people. And I, Simon, I have this thing I put together. It's the universal rule of 90, that in any given case, like with the Warrens, 30% of the people are going to love the Warrens, 30% are going to hate the Warrens, and 30% could care either way. With the case of the Warrens, it's more than 30% disliking them. It's probably 40% or 50%. They are highly disliked on many reasons. And, you know, I mentioned the commercial thing. They were commercially successful. And because of that, many people think that somehow they were disingenuous, that they, that somehow because they were commercially successful and making money, that somehow that was wrong, or that was, they were con artists. That wasn't true. There's pagans and Wiccans that don't like Ed and Lorraine because in, when you look at witchcraft, they believe that demonic forces, dark forces can coexist with us in harmony. And with Ed and Lorraine Warren and their Christian ideals and beliefs, it's all black and white. It's good versus evil. And there's no shades of gray that allow for these negative energies or demonic energies or whatever you want to call them. But they're part of us, part of our shadow persona, as Jung said. So there's many people that dislike Ed and Lorraine Warren. There was talk about Ed having a young girlfriend in the house that was sanctioned by Lorraine. I don't even look at that, consider it, you know, talk about it. I don't know. I don't know anything about that. And that's none of my business. And it's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about what they did for the realm of demonology, what they did with their investigations, what they did with the books that they wrote. So that's what I'm focusing on. And, you know, and again, you know, the, when somebody starts saying something critical of our, of someone who's not in the room, you know, that person that's not there needs to have somebody stand up and defend them, you know, defend their honor when they're not there. And I do that with Ed and Lorraine. I mean, I'm just, you know, I stand tall in their defense.
So with the Schmerl haunting, how did it start? What was the first things they started to notice?
Well, it happened in 1972. And if you live in northeastern Pennsylvania, you're used to having floods. I mean, we tend to get a 100-year flood, you know what they call a 100-year flood. We tend to get one of those every 7 years. But in 1972, we had the Agnes flood that drenched northeastern Pennsylvania for days, went back out to the Atlantic and came back with more rain. And northeastern Pennsylvania, especially Wilkes-Barre and Scranton, were devastated. Jack and Janet Schmerl were flooded out, and they found a place in West Pittston, Pennsylvania. So that's how they made their way to West Pittston, which is a very nice community, you know, just, you know, a tree line, you know, nice community values. I mean, just a wonderful place to raise a family. So they had a duplex, and they were there with their two daughters. Jack's parents lived on the other side. And then later they had two other daughters, Shannon and I forget the other one, but there were, but they had a total of four daughters there. So that's how they made their way to West Pittston. And then little by little, there were signs of something going wrong. Rooms would be, despite having a working furnace, the rooms would be ice cold in temperature. Televisions would blow up, brand new televisions. Light fixtures would fall down. There would be grunting sounds. There would be horrible smells, and not from a damaged sewer system, but from just like horrible, horrible, you know, sulfur, fecal odor smells. Profanities would be etched in the mirrors. And it just kept on going on and on. And it started very light, and then it got heavier and darker and more intense. Of course, the worst of it was when Jack claimed that he was raped by the demon, the female demon, the succubus. And the Warrens, very devout Catholics, told the church about this. And so the church sent over some priest, and the one priest did a blessing. He blessed the house. Another priest would spend the night there listening for things, and sometimes they heard things, other times they didn't. And then it reached the point where it was getting out of hand. And at that point, Janet Schmerl reached out to Ed and Lorraine Warren. And Janet Schmerl had heard about the Warrens on TV, on a TV program. And so she reached out to the Warrens, who lived in Connecticut, you know, not very far from northeastern Pennsylvania. And finally, the Warrens came down because of the encouragement from the Schmerl family.
Is there a thing where the Schmerl family were strong Catholics? They were very religious in some way.
Oh, well, they were religious in every way. Yeah, they were devout Catholics, churchgoers, believed in the power of Christ. You know, they were without a doubt. I think that may be one of the reasons why they were targeted. And, you know, when you ask in the realm of demonology, you know, again, if you believe in this, if you subscribe to that this actually exists, there's different reasons why people could become infested or possessed. One could be a curse. Somebody could put a curse on you. And certainly in Pennsylvania, especially in Lancaster, we have plenty of white witches and, you know, Amish farmers that have, you know, traditionally had hex signs and placed curses on their neighbor's cow or whatever. I mean, just like crazy stuff. But I mean, that's part of our backdrop here. But I don't think it was a curse that was placed on them. I believe that because they were Christians, they had a target on their back. I believe that the devil delights in taking down people that have dedicated their life to Christ and to the Word of God. And that's what I believe happened in their case. I think that they were targeted, and these demonic forces tormented them and infested the house. And that's what I believe happened. But yes, they were devout Catholics, and they believed in that. And they were good people. And even Father McKenna, and Father McKenna was the one that Ed and Lorraine Warren brought to help cleanse the house. But Father Bishop McKenna said this. He says, quote, "Why has a demon chosen to infest the lives of the Schmerls, who are religious, hardworking, and sincere people?" He questioned that. I mean, why them? Why them? They were good people. You know, they were in every gauge that we would look at someone. I mean, they were, you know, hardworking, good family, you know, all that. So, you know, but again, why do bad things happen to good people? You know, that's another age-old question that I don't know the answer to that. But yes, the Schmerls, as well as the Warrens, were Roman Catholics.
Was there any history at the house of stuff happening before they moved there?
I don't believe so. I think it happened with them again when, after the Agnes flood of 1972, they moved in there. And then little by little, things started to happen around, say, 1986, and they got more and more. The book, The Haunted, was written. It came out in 1988, and that was written by Robert Curran, C-U-R-R-A-N. He was a northeastern Pennsylvania journalist. He had been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for doing a investigative journalism on the Clark Summit Mental Institution, where there were countless episodes of patient abuse, you know, horrible, barbaric things. But he was a wonderful writer. But the problem with his 1988 book, The Haunted, was that it wasn't only his wonderful prose, but also he had writings from Jack and Janet Schmerl, who were not writers. They weren't journalists. They were people that were traumatized. And also he had notations from Ed and Lorraine Warren, who, again, were not journalists. They weren't writers. They were, you know, demonologists. So Robert Curran's book, The Haunted, was a combination. It was a potpourri of his wonderful prose and then also the other prose from the Warrens and the Schmerls that really wasn't that good. So, you know, the book, even though it sold millions of copies and made a lot of money for his publisher, and even though Fox TV had a special TV program on about that, and so the book and the program made a lot of money and brought a lot of notoriety to the Schmerl home in West Pittston, Pennsylvania. But Simon, the creme de la creme was 2025, and just this past weekend, The Conjuring Last Rites came out, and it came out on September the 5th, 2025. And in that weekend, it grossed around $1 billion. It made it the third biggest opening for any horror movie after It and It Part Two. So I'm hoping that the Schmerl Haunting is around. The movie is The Last Rites is around for a while, because my book, The Schmerl Haunting, really piggybacks on that and tells the story of demonology. And of course, the Last Rites is a horror movie. I mean, they put it together to scare us. So if you want to go and be frightened and entertained, go see The Last Rites. But if you want to be educated as to demonology and the rite of exorcism and how the Schmerl Haunting fits in with other demonic places, then read the book, The Schmerl Haunting. It's probably the epitome. I mean, like, I'm just so proud of that book, and so is Anxiety Press. It's, you know, it's well-researched, and this is, you know, for those people that are involved and, you know, curious about demonology, just get this book, read it, and judge for yourself.
So with the Schmerl family, did they all move out? Was it like they were only there for a month, or what happened?
No, they stayed there for years. And but what happened was, you know, with demonic infestation, we believe that demonic energies can infest people, places, or things. Now, certainly it infested the Schmerl house in West Pittston, Pennsylvania. It may have infested some of the people, because the Schmerls went on a camping trip, and there were things that happened there of a very, you know, very bizarre nature, you know, just weird paranormal things. So they believe that these demonic forces follow them. But also, and I talk about this in my book, The Schmerl Haunting, Annabelle, the probably the most well-known artifact that that Ed and Lorraine Warren owns. Annabelle was taken on tour, and I was able to see Annabelle when Annabelle appeared in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania in July. And that added another chapter, another element of the paranormal to this book, and brought me closer to being a part of it, almost. I mean, not that I was asking for any of this or looking for it, but this Schmerl Haunting and Ed and Lorraine Warren, this whole thing is very personal to me, you know, on many, many different levels.
And you talk about these things following people. Did Ed and Lorraine ever have something follow them home?
Well, Ed and Lorraine dealt with all of these things. Now, again, what they did was they kept themselves you know, filled with God's grace, the crucifix, the holy water, all this. I mean, they stood firm with God's power. That we believe that the power of Satan is tremendous, but the power of God is even stronger. So that was what they believed in. Ed was a bit of an exorcist, and he tried an exorcism at the Schmerl house, which did not work. The Catholic Church sent in their exorcist, and every Catholic diocese has a priest who is skilled in the medieval art of exorcism, and they tried to chase away the demons, and they couldn't. Finally, Bishop Timlin from Scranton, Pennsylvania, brought in Father Alphonse Trebol, and Father Trebol from New York State came down, and he performed four exorcisms, before he finally was able to cleanse the Schmerl haunting. The Schmerls had left the house prior to this. They couldn't take it anymore, so they left, and they went to found another house in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. But the Catholic Church wanted to go and remedy this. And one of the reasons was because it was just getting so much media attention that they were almost forced to do something, and which they did. But that all along, they were involved in trying to cleanse the house. It's not that they tried to ignore it, because they didn't. They were, you know, the local priests were involved with this. But it was Father Alphonse Trebol who finally was able to go and, cleanse the property. Now, here's the thing, too. I want to say this about Father Trebol. He was able to cleanse the Schmerl haunts, but he also went to the Hinsdale House in New York, and that's in the lower tier of New York, in the western part of the state. And he went there, and he tried to excise the Hinsdale House, and he couldn't. And he told the people there, just leave this house. Don't tell anyone where you're going. Just leave in silence. Leave your belongings. This place is a gateway to hell. Just leave it there. Father Trebol was not able to cleanse the Hinsdale house because it was too demonic and too evil. And what is equally bizarre is that even today, you could spend an overnight there for a certain fee. You could spend the night there at the Hinsdale house in Western New York State, you know, for a price. So I have a very, you know, I'm very, very skeptical and concerned about that, because I don't think that that's a good idea. If there are demonic energies there, then, you know, a person who is vulnerable is a likely target.
So if the Hinsdale house had some sort of thing where he said it was like a connection to hell or something?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, he believed that there's some places there that have more demonic energies than others. And for some reason, this Hinsdale house in New York was one of those. And Father Trebol said, just leave. Don't waste your time. Don't waste your energies. Just protect yourself from this evil. He was really concerned about this. And he was there with a psychic, a very famed psychic that sort of was a bit of his partner. But that was Alexander Tanis, and he was a New England psychic, and he investigated the haunted Hinsdale house. But Alexander Tanis was just like a wonderful individual, and very famous and legendary in his own right.
So do you think the Schmerl house might have had some kind of portal or something that was letting this stuff through?
I think it was the Schmerls. I think that because, again, this is my theory, but I think that because of their faith, because of their Christianity and their Catholicism, that became the target on their back. And because of their faith, they were targeted and the demons came after them. Again, you know, I mean, there were a lot of people in West Pittston. Why was it only the Schmerls, you know, that were targeted? And one of the identifiers for them was their religious belief. So that's what I believe.
So could there be a thing where Ed and Lorraine Warren were Catholics and the Schmelz were, but if the people who were involved were atheists, perhaps, or had a belief in the afterlife, they might interpret what happened completely differently?
Well, I'm not sure. I think that even with atheists, you know, they the focal point is God or a higher power, you know, whether it exists or it doesn't. But I mean, it's always there at the center of their philosophy. But I don't know. I don't know how an atheist would view this. But I know I have numerous friends who are pagans and Wiccans, and they believe in a demonic presence or an evil presence that we can coexist with. That maybe it's part of us, part of our shadow self, part of, you know, that. But coexistence seems to be what they are calling for, not, you know, casting out these demons and, you know, and separating them and segregating them from us. So it's just another viewpoint. And, you know, as we walk our journey, you know, we pick our philosophies, our mantras, we take what's been given to us from our parents, our community, our church, our schools, and we go on this journey, you know, with those philosophies and those beliefs. And, you know, and if your belief is that the world is filled with dangerous, evil things, then that will be in your head. Or if you believe that the world is a wondrous place, you know, of adventure and experience and friendship and joy, and if that's your belief, well, then that's what's going to be in your head along the journey. But we're all pretty much the same. We walk the journey. We don't know what the destination is. None of us do. And even with, you know, my book, The Schmerl Haunting, I would love to have it a bestseller and, you know, and all that. I mean, as an author, you know, you hope for that. But, you know, that doesn't happen with everybody. It happens with very few. So it doesn't matter, because along the way on my journey, I'm meeting a lot of people like you, Simon, and I'm able to interact and share ideas and philosophies. And that's what's important. So, you know, whatever happens with the book is up to the universe. I mean, if the universe recognizes it and picks it up and, you know, lifts it up there, well, then fine, because all this, you know, needs, you know, I'm willing to do the hard work, but, you know, we need a little bit of luck, serendipity, a little bit of karma, you know, for this to go anyplace. But anyway, it's all good. I'm just glad to be, you know, doing what I'm doing and, you know, talking to you on your program. So.
Hi, this is Simon. Do you have a fascination with reincarnation? And would you like to know about your past lives? I have a diploma in clinical hypnotherapy, and I conduct past life regression sessions over Zoom. If you'd like to find out how a session works for you, you can book a free 20-minute consultation on my website. That's at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The link is in the show notes. So did Ed Warren have training in exorcism, or did he work it out himself?
I think he was pretty much, you know, homeschooled. I mean, he had an interest in it. Lorraine believed that she had abilities as a clairvoyant. But Ed was able, he was a former law enforcement person. He was a former naval guy. He was in the Navy. And he and Lorraine met early in life. I think they were 17, maybe 16, 17, something like that. But they both shared common values as far as demonology and Christianity and how that all converged. So she believed that she had the power of clairvoyance, that she could see things, feel things. And he thought that he was able to go and perform the rite of exorcism. And again, I'm pretty sure that he was self-taught. But one thing that Lorraine Warren would do, she would go into this house that was possessed, and she would lay down on the bed and try to go and invoke those vibrations, you know, those spirits, and to find out what was there. So with the Schmerl Haunting, she believed that there were four spirits, one of which was demonic, and this demonic spirit was manipulating the other three. an old man, a young boy, and an older woman. So that was what Lorraine said, but she felt that this demon, and it makes sense when you study demonology, that this one demon was able to manipulate the other spirits there, these other entities, and make them harass the Shmurls. And that's exactly what they did. But a lot of things that were very, very dangerous. The chandelier, a brand new chandelier, falling down, almost killing one of the kids. Or the one thing that happened was with Dawn Schmurl, Simon, their German Shepherd, she watched as Simon was lifted up and thrown across the room against the wall. And that in itself has become controversial because some people have attributed Simon's levitation to demonic forces, while others claim that it's possible that Dawn Schmurl was manifesting some psychokinetic energies. And Stephen King has made so much, has been so successful writing about young people, especially young women with psychokinetic powers in books like Firestarter and The Shining and Carrie. And these are typically adolescent women that have all this angst, this buildup angst, but it's actually a power that they can't control. Now, the theory is that Dawn Schmurl herself manifested this psi power and threw Simon Simon the dog, but not the podcaster, against the wall. So that was an interesting theory, but that's been making its rounds too. So who knows? I mean, there's different levels. I mean, that's what's so amazing about the paranormal. You know, we try to figure out what it is because it lies beyond the realm of the scientific explanation. You know, we don't know, but we look at the theories and we try to figure out, what's the best theory that could explain this.
So is there an interdimensional kind of theory? Because there's some thought that everything's all connected. It could be UFOs and the afterlife and hauntings. Is there some kind of interdimensional thing there?
Yeah, I think there would be, and I think interdimensional would be the right word. But again, when you talk about things like Ouija boards and seances and fortune tellers and all of that, I mean, many people warn others to be careful. You know, especially nowadays, there are so many younger people that are ghost hunters, and they'll go into these abandoned mental institutions or abandoned prisons and look for spirits. Well, it's very possible that there could be demons lurking there, demons who are just waiting for innocent, naive, vulnerable victims to show up. So, we need to be careful about that. And when they talk about Ouija boards being a portal to something unknown, something forbidden, we believe that there may be a forbidden dimension, portal to that. Certainly, there's other people that use Ouija boards that people that are naive will just wait to see what shows up with the Ouija board, through the power of the Ouija board, what spirit shows up, either good energy or demonic energy. Others, though, who are more skilled in Ouija boards are looking for a specific spirit that they connect with through the Ouija board that will give them information. So there's a difference between utilizing a Ouija board knowingly and purposefully rather than just doing it haphazardly and waiting for whatever to show up. So, there's a rhyme or reason with some of these things. But for most people that are naive and not educated to the to things like Ouija boards, I would just warn them, to stay away. If you don't know what you're doing, you may be, finding yourself in a lot of trouble.
Is it right that Ouija boards were originally sold like a game, like maybe Monopoly?
Yeah, I think they were. But, you know, back in the, I don't know when they started, but back in the 20s when we had that era of spiritualism where they, everyone was doing seances and we were so much into this, you know, that the 1920s and 1930s were really so huge with this. And that sort of went out of favor. But now the paranormal and the supernatural has come back. It's been resurrected and it's not going away. I mean, people want to know about the paranormal. And I think one reason may be, well, it's clear. There's fewer people going to church. There's fewer people that are subscribing to organized religion for a lot of different reasons. But humans as being cognitive and spiritual entities, I mean, we need to demonstrate that spirituality. And if we don't demonstrate that by going to church on Sundays and praying and tithing and all that, then we do it in other ways. And that may be by going out looking for Bigfoot, you know, at the campfires, or by going, you know, to haunted houses and whatever. But I mean, I think we have a need to connect with the paranormal and express our spirituality that way. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. That's only being human. That's only doing what we have to do. And I want to say this, you know, with human beings, we are blessed because we have an overabundance of DNA. And this is a case of more being better, you know, more DNA giving us more cognition and more spirituality over the animals. I mean, we have better language skills, we have better tool making skills, better communication skills, and better and more, and we are more spiritual than are the animals. And as much as people try to talk about how dolphins and porpoise and whales and monkeys, you know, chimps, you know, have so much going for them, man has more. And the only difference is that, you know, in the animal world, you have stimulus response. In the human world, you know, hopefully we have stimulus cognition response. Typically, you know, we should think before we act. So, but that sets us apart from the animals. And, you know, that spirituality should never, and cognition should never be ignored. It should be respected. It's what makes us unique as human beings. So let's hope that continues.
I wanted to talk to you about the Amityville house. It was George and Kathy Lutz that moved in, wasn't it? And then what happened? Yep. How did that all start?
Yeah, and I have a chapter about that because Amityville is just infamous, and it's infamous. And when you just Google that and take a look at all the books and motion pictures written about Amityville, I mean, it's 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times more than any other haunted house out there, more. And there's something about Amityville that just triggers something. And what it is, it was Butch DeFeo, a 23-year-old rich kid, you know, who lived in Amityville, Long Island. His parents had money. Butch would walk around with thousands of dollars in his pocket. But he got a rifle. He shot his father twice, his mother twice, killed his two sisters and his two brothers. And they talked about 8 shots, 6 autopsies. Butch DeFeo claimed that he was possessed by a demon. And during the trial of Butch DeFeo, they had to prove that he wasn't possessed by demons. And this demonology entered into the American judicial system. It entered into the American courtroom. And the prosecution had to demonstrate that Butch DeFeo was not possessed by a demon, but that he was a personality disorder, i.e., he had no empathy or compassion for his fellow humans, and also he needed instant gratification, whether it was with the drugs, the sex, whatever, the violence. So Amityville resonates, it continues to resonate, and it doesn't matter who writes the book, it's going to become a bestseller. And I'll give you a good example. With George and Kathy Lutz, they moved into the house. I think they purchased it for $80,000 after the DeFeo murders. And it was a bargain price, but all kinds of demonic things happened and they were chased out. They believed it was demonic forces. Now, There was a book written by George Lutz's attorney, and he claimed that over a couple bottles of wine, they conjured up the story of the Amityville Horror, claimed that he made it up. Well, let me say this, Simon. You know, here's another book about Amityville. Doesn't matter what you write about. In this case, they said it was a hoax, and that book did well. It sold well. It doesn't matter what the theme is. You know, we could write a book about how we time traveled back to Amityville and committed those murders. Whatever, whatever way you want to go and view it or slice it and dice it, it's going to make money because Amityville is a cash cow. It's a cottage industry. Amityville is a brand of its own. And in my book, The Schmerl Haunting, I compare the Schmerl House with Amityville. And one thing that ties it all together is Ed and Lorraine Warren, because they were one of the first investigators to investigate Amityville, as they also investigated Hinsdale and the damned Wells House and also the Schmerl Haunting. So Ed and Lorraine Warren were there front and center, you know, investigating all of these cases of demonic infestation, including the one over in North London that the Catholic Church sent them over there. So, you know, that became part of their resume as well.
That was the Enfield poltergeist, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. And to this day, we're not exactly sure what happened there, what the reality is. But again, you know, you're talking about haunted houses, you know, with similar themes, similar things happening. And, you know, I mean, again, you could go through the different reasons. You could say that it was collective hallucinations. You could say that the collective energies of people conjured things to happen. And they said that about the Schmerl Haunting. They said that the Schmerls just collectively thought this and conjured this up. But again, that is a really wild theory that I don't think it holds water at all. But again, as a paranormal researcher, as an author, we need to go and at least consider it. And that's all we're doing. We're just considering some of these hypotheses. What makes sense and what doesn't make sense? Simon, what you said about the interdimensional theory, certainly that dimensionality of demonology needs to be taken a look at, because there may be realms, you know, forbidden realms, hidden realms, evil realms that coexist with us and may take only a Ouija board or a seance to open up the door to that realm. So we don't know. But I mean, that's the theory that's been around for you know, hundreds of years.
Could you describe one of the shocking events that happened at the Amityville House?
Yeah, the your typical listing of things like the smells, the grunting sound, the little girl seeing a pig, and then the flies. There were just like horrible, horrible infestations of flies at the window. There were rooms that were ice cold. So again, the things that happened, the events, the occurrences that happened weren't unique in themselves, because, you know, we've seen things like this in other haunted houses. I mean, I think maybe the flies were unique. Maybe the child seeing the pig, the pet pig, the evil pig, you know, her friend, this pig that was there, you know, that might have been one of those. But as I said earlier, the thing that, the worst one was the level of violence at the Schmerl Haunting, and that was Jack Schmerl being raped by a demon. And that didn't happen in any of the other cases that I've researched. And that makes the Schmerl Haunting unique in the annals of haunted houses, makes it more violent, more physically violent, and, you know, an amazing thing. But
so do you feel that there may be some hoaxing amongst these cases?
Well, there's always hoaxing, you know, with, I think with ufology, we've had a ton of cases. And let's take a look at ufology, cryptozoology, and demonology. In ufology, people like George Adamski was able to go and have photographs of light bulbs and these chicken incubators. And he claimed that these were flying saucers. I mean, they were clearly not saucers, but people believed him. People believed him. But he was a very successful hoaxer. And he's been called out, but, you know, he was sort of a proponent of a new age philosophy and that, you know, so his hoaxing is cobbled together with his new ageism. And, you know, so he sort of, you know, gets by on that. With cryptozoology, we've had plenty of people. And I think one of the best ones was the Piltdown Man that took place over in the UK. And they claim that the Piltdown Man was the oldest a human relic. And part of this, I mean, this was a hoax that lasted for 40 years, but part of this was that, you know, at that point, the UK, some of the people in the UK, both politicians and scientists, wanted to have their own Heidelberg Man. And at that time, the Heidelberg Man was the oldest known human relic, and that was found in Germany. Well, with the Piltdown Man, if that would be proven to be legitimate, it would have the UK would then have the oldest relic, and they found out that it wasn't. It was a hoax. It was they used an old skull, human skull, coupled together with a jaw of an orangutan, and then all of the bones were doctored with iron oxide to make them look older, and the teeth of the orangutan were chiseled down to make it look more human-like. So it was just a hoax that lasted for 40 years. So that was infamous. But with demonology, other than the hoaxes that we found in the 1920s and 30s with seances and everything, I don't know, you know, what stands out. I mean, some people say that Amityville was a hoax, you know, with George Lutz's attorney, but I don't believe that. I just believe that he decided that he could make some money by writing about Amityville and claiming that was a hoax, and that was his take, and that was his book, and, you know, and that seems to be almost like the last word. A lot of people, when they talk about Amityville, say, oh, well, yeah, the attorney wrote a book about it and claimed it was a hoax, but that's not the end of the story. There was more before and more after, and that's not the final thing. And besides, where's his validity? Where's his proof? I mean, we don't know. So all we know is that he made money with that book. So, but I don't know of other hoaxes in the realm of demonology. Certainly, there's people that believe that Ed and Lorraine exaggerated and that they were con artists and all this. And there's many people that dislike the Warrens for all the obvious reasons. But I believe that they were telling the truth and that their investigations were legitimate.
Well, it's been great talking to you again. And the book's called The Smurl Haunting, When Ed and Lorraine Came to Town. People can get that on Amazon, can they, and other places?
Yeah, and I would recommend that if your readers would, if they would check out my website, they could get it on there. It's www.maximfurek.com, MAXIMFUREK.com. And if they would be so kind as to purchase a copy of The Smurl Haunting, I would ask them to please leave a review on Amazon. It's the best thing that you could do for us authors. So if you could, if the readers could do that, I would really appreciate that. And Simon, thank you so much for a very in-depth interview. You do a great job as always. And, you know, I want to thank you for the invitation. It means a lot to me.
Well, that's great. Thanks a lot. Did you want to just quickly tell us about your other books?
Yeah, if you get on www.maximfurek.com, you could read about Coal Region Hoodoo, which is really rocking the house. I mean, has, you know, quite a few reviews on Amazon. And also my latest one is Paranormal Apocalypse. Is This How It Ends? And I'm hoping that in the near future, we might be able to have another chat about the Paranormal Apocalypse that just came out.
Yeah, that'd be great. All right. Well, thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Simon, and continued success with you.
This week, I was talking to Maxim Furek about his book, The Smurl Haunting, When Ed and Lorraine Came to Town. If you want to hear the rest of this amazing interview, you can sign up to Patreon. When you sign up for $6 a month, you get an extended episode every week. For $3 a month, you get an extended episode every month. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And my book, titled Verified Near-Death Experiences, is out on Amazon. You can get it on paperback, audiobook, or on Kindle. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.